Hello and welcome to Psychology in Seattle. I'm your host, Kirk Honda, professor and licensed therapist.
And I'm Umberto Castaneda. I'm an NFL historian.
All right, today's episode is about the movie American Psycho. I recently came across a psychology paper about American Psycho, and I remembered that it's Umberto's favorite movie.
Yes.
So I thought, let's make a podcast about this paper and about the movie and about all that. So let's get going. Why do you love the movie so much, Berto?
Part of it is an emotional connection to when I saw it and how I saw it. But here's the deal. When I watched it, I didn't have a lot of context, except that I had read an article a few years back saying, hey, this thing called American Psycho is being made into a movie, and it's got Leonardo DiCaprio in it, because he was originally going to be the American Psycho. And I thought, wow, that sounds interesting. And then I kind of lost track of it. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I know Leonardo's out. This movie's coming out with this unknown guy, right? Christian Bale at the time. Yeah. He'd been in stuff, but it's like...
Newsies!
Whatever, right? And so I go with some friends, and that's... I don't have much context other than that. So I don't know really to what... I hadn't read the book. I didn't really know about Bret Easton Ellis at the time, even though I had seen Less Than Zero when I was a kid or whatever. But so I go and I watch it, and the whole movie, I'm just mesmerized because, A, the style of the movie was fantastic. Like, just stylistically, the scenery, the decor, the way they use the lighting, the way they use the angles, the shots, everything is so perfect. Second, the sheer satire about the 80s and about the greed and about Wall Street and about all that stuff, that's just fascinating. And then coupled with this character that they create is so fascinating, right? I mean, if you believe he's doing everything he's doing, it's fascinating from the same way that you're fascinated about a Ted Bundy or something, right? And you're horrified, but you're like, Jesus. But if you don't believe, or if you think, wait, there's something off here, then there's this hilariousness to his awful atrocities, right? And then his whole surrounding circle of friends, one is more clueless than the other. And it is so grotesque and so ugly, but also so hilarious. And so all that stuff, it was like this roller coaster ride watching the movie. And I come out of the movie, and half of the people I was with are like, that sucked. I don't even know what happened. Was he actually imagining it all? What happened? And then the other half of us were like, oh my God, that's the greatest thing we've ever seen.
What distinguished the two groups?
If you think that you were watching a horror movie, for example, if you think that's what you were doing, then you're going to be disappointed because it's not a typical horror movie by any means, right? And also, there are things that are confusing in it if you're trying to follow it linearly. Like, if you're trying to make the movie make sense linearly, it won't make sense. And if you're trying to resolve it all neatly, what did actually happen? It won't work. And the main reason is because it's an unreliable narrator. The person telling you the story is the psycho. So you already have someone that doesn't really know what's reality. There were some of us that enjoyed the aesthetics and that premise. We were fine with the premise. We're like, oh, okay, this crazy, insane person who may just be a metaphor is telling us this story. So I'm okay with it not making sense. And I think other folks were like, that didn't make sense.
Right, because if you watch it literally, it doesn't make much sense.
No.
And it's hard to tell.
And there's contradictory scenes, and then you're like, but wait, did he really? But wait, right. Oh, the gun blew up a cop car? What the hell? You know, stuff like that.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about scene by scene the movie a little bit. Not scene by scene, but let's kind of just go through the movie. I watched it again last night to bone up because it had been a while. I've probably seen it about 3 or 4 times. I actually own the VHS tape. It's in my bathroom. Have you seen it there?
I haven't seen the VHS in your bathroom, but oh, maybe I have actually.
Yeah.
The box is there. You're right.
It's not one of my favorite movies. I like it, but and it's actually, it comes from a different time when they made movies shorter. It's actually not that short. I think it's like maybe 1 hour and 40 minutes, but it feels really short because
It's snippy. Yeah,
almost every movie now is just like a little too long. Unless I love the movie, then it's too short.
So the intro is already brilliant, right? Because you're sitting there, this plain white screen. You're like, what's happening? And all of a sudden, this blood starts dripping, and you're like, oh, it gracefully evolves into this raspberry jam or whatever they're putting on the super expensive fancy dessert, right? And it's these idiots talking about business and stuff. It's a brilliant start. I just, like, right off the bat, I'm sold.
I remember one time you talking about how you wanted to model your life after him.
Yes.
Because there was this scene where he was talking about the facial mask yes. and the face scrub, and he was in his perfect condo with perfect white everything and perfect art, and everything was clean, and he went into his big bathroom and his big shower, and he had all these perfect products and everything, and he was like perfectly fit, and he did the perfect yes. and you I remember you saying, like, after that you started buying all these facial creams and stuff.
I misunderstood. I was like, okay, if I buy all these fancy products for my skin, I will look like Christian Bale at his fittest.
Yeah. So basically the movie starts off, they're at that fancy dinner, and one of the women, one of the extras, I just noticed had those humongous bangs from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember those bangs in the 80s?
Well, sort of, yes and no. So, A, yes, because they were even in Colombia. But remember, I lived in Colombia, right? So a lot of the...
But you came to the States.
In 90.
Oh.
So, but... Keep in mind, all our media and our influences and music
yeah.
was all coming from here.
Yeah.
So I saw the bangs both in TV stuff, in music, and the girls at our school, they copied all that stuff. So
man, the bangs in the 80s, I was in high school. I was probably at bangs like ground zero, because I think high school kids are the worst when it comes to doing the worst thing out there. Do you know what I mean?
Well, let me ask you this question, though. Are they still doing it? Because, meaning...
Yeah.
What I mean is...
Absolutely. It, like if you see kids today,
yeah.
you know how the Justin Bieber hair or yeah. the sort of emo, you know, the
oh, yeah,
the
yeah.
What would you call it? Like, long bangs where the guy is constantly flipping his hair.
Yes.
The high school students, or maybe freshmen in high school, are the worst culprits of that.
Oh.
They always do the most advanced version of whatever trend is out there. And when I was in high school, I was in high school from 85 to 89, which I think was right smack dab in the middle of the big bangs thing. And the girls in my school, I remember just doing these outlandish bangs, but I think I liked it because I was right in the middle of that culture. And I don't remember poo pooing it. I never
thought it looked right. I always thought it looked like an accident.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, And sometimes I think when you look at the models and the women of that time that were in the media, their bangs were big, but they had hairstylists to make right. it to make the whole ensemble on their sure. head look right. But when you're a girl and you have, you know, 15 minutes and you're all by yourself,
you just have the bangs,
and you have like the foamy mousse and your blow dryer and your mom saying, we gotta go, your bangs aren't gonna look quite right every
nope.
time. Yeah.
Nope.
So anyway, I had
an embarrassing one too, because in a haircut, I mean, the
oh, I did too. Oh my God.
I
had a flock of seagulls.
Oh, I kind of would have gone that way. So I was trying to grow my hair as long as I could in the front.
You had a flock of seagulls just like a few years ago.
That's true. I did do that. No, but I was trying to grow it as long as I could. Right. So it was down to like below my chin on the front.
Was it short on the sides and the back?
No.
Oh, no.
So I had a helmet of hair, and then this long ass hair in the front. There's some pictures of me as 14 or 15 where I'm like, oh God.
Right. So that's what I'm talking about. Like, everyone, I would say most people, if they look at themselves at age 15, they have the worst haircuts they've ever had in their
yeah.
life.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I noticed that, and then I noticed they were playing New Order, which is great. You know,
the soundtrack is great, both ironically and literally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is when I noticed the first behavior from Patrick Bateman that indicates something is wrong with him. The bartender refuses to take his tickets for drinks, and she says, "We don't accept tickets anymore. This is a cash only bar," and he gives her a credit card or cash or something. She turns around and he says, "I want to stab you to death and play with your blood." And he says this with a smile on his face.
"I want to stab you to death and play with your blood."
And
but he doesn't even like, he's not, when you see him saying it, because you don't know if it's a movie effect, when you see him saying it, it is filmed in such a way to make you believe he is literally saying that directly to her with no connotation other than I mean it.
Yeah. But she doesn't apparently hear him.
That's right.
Because it's a loud club that they're in.
Perhaps, right.
Or he was hallucinating saying it.
Or he wanted to say that.
Yeah, it was only in his head, yeah. But the way he says it, he's not angry. He doesn't say it with, he's not like losing his, he's not losing his temper and saying something out of anger. He's saying it in a cold, calculated way.
Yes, that's what he literally wants to do.
Or does he, right? Because is he playing a part, or does he actually want to do that, or what is it?
It is, and in that moment, I do get the sense that that's like him drawing in his notebook, right?
Yeah.
That's like that. But there are moments throughout the movie where you see him obviously lose his cool about things that he shouldn't be losing his cool about.
Right, like someone else having a better car.
Yeah.
But it's implied that the other guys around him have the same reaction to it. Maybe not as extreme, but yeah, they all care about how
absolutely
Paul Allen can get the reservation at Dorsia and no one else can. By the way, in the book, it's Paul Owen, but in the movie, it's Paul Allen.
Right.
Were they trying to...
No, they weren't, but I don't know why. That was such an arbitrary change.
Was there a famous Paul Owen they were trying to avoid?
No.
Because there's a famous Paul Allen.
Yeah, I know, but I remember an interview with the lady who directed it or whatever, and that was not an intentional thing. Because this was the 80s anyways.
Right.
There was zero connection to the Microsoft Paul Allen.
Have you ever met Paul Allen?
No, I've never met him.
Personally. Oh, ever met Bill Gates?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, the first time I met him, it was like walking by. The second time I met him was in a product review, uh-huh. and I had to say my piece.
Uh-huh.
And then the last time I met him was in another review type meeting where he was kind of yelling at someone.
Is he nerdy?
He's not very nerdy in those meetings because they're ruthless.
Well, isn't the story of Microsoft that Bill Gates was a ruthless businessman? Like he was constantly...
He was very driven, very, he saw the opportunities that other people, I guess, were not seeing.
Yeah, like, didn't he buy the first version of Windows from some other guy for like
80 grand or something.
80 grand,
yep.
And all the while knew he was going to make millions off of it.
10 grand, and he licensed it for 80 or something. Yeah, I mean, yes, he was very smart, very savvy, and he understood the technology and where it was going to go. And he was very good at wheeling and dealing and getting his way.
Yeah. Every day...
And people followed him.
Almost every day, I either walk by or drive by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is just like a couple blocks from here. And they have this really interesting-looking visitor center in the bottom floor of the foundation, right? Foundation? Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And I've never been inside. I've lived here for almost 4 years or something. Yeah. I've never been inside. It looks really interesting anyway. And they have a really bizarre... constantly playing TV screen out front that has all these weird art things going on. I have no idea what they're doing. Okay. So that's the first time that you see him where he obviously has a lot of aggression towards people that bother him even in the slightest way. He goes into his perfect condo and there's a voiceover of him talking and he's saying, there is no real me. There's this ironic or I don't know, symbolic scene where he's taking this mask off his face, which is that beauty mask that you put on and it's see-through and he's taking off a mask that looks just like him. And it reveals him. Do you know what I mean?
The mask almost had more more personality than what's being revealed underneath.
Right.
Because his expression is so dour, so like, and you get this again when he's getting the spa treatment.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
And remember, he's like, what does he say? He's like, he's not repulsed. He's like. He has such disdain for the person helping him or something.
Yeah. And then they break into Walking on Sunshine.
Yeah.
Which was a huge song when I was in high school, by the way.
And he's wearing the big headphones.
Right.
The Walkman.
That was another thing. So he has a Walkman and those typical Walkman headphones fuzzy ones. And I can't tell you how that just brings me back to the 80s because I actually had a boombox. It was a dual cassette boombox.
Wow.
So you could dub tapes, right? And one of the cassette decks was a detachable Walkman.
What?
Yeah. So one of the cassette decks, you could actually press this button and it, and this whole
Transformer
thing came out. And then I had this like gold Walkman I could walk around. And I remember listening to the Beatles and Husker Du.
Wow.
And INXS and Devo. And
that's cool.
Who else? So I'm going to talk about a lot of things from the 80s actually, because that was a big part of it for me. He goes into his office and there's no computer on his desk.
I know. A what?
there's just a phone, I think. And I just thought, oh, that's right. Back in the day, normal people didn't have computers. Right. And so I thought that was interesting.
And so you think, what does he do?
You still don't really know.
What does he do? He's a vice president.
Mergers and acquisitions.
For murders and executions.
Yeah. He just says all these really alarming things that no one reacts to, right?
Yes.
And you know, he's very concerned about reservations, and his girlfriend is asked, who's played by Legally Blonde.
Yes. What is her name?
He says, because I want to fit in, he says.
He's not listening to her. He's got his headphones on again, right?
Yeah.
And they're planning the wedding, right? She says something like, "Why? I don't even know why you go to work. Like, you don't even have to work," or something like that, because your dad owns the company or something, right? And he's like, "Because I want to fit in."
Yeah. And she doesn't even respond to that. They both seem oblivious to what each other is
saying. And that moment is so interesting, right? Because there's this layer of him. Again, I don't know if it's a metaphor or if it's him imagining. I don't know what layer it is, but there's a layer of him that's aware of what a parody of reality he is.
Right.
Because that moment when he says, I want to fit in, is so self-aware.
Right.
Right? That's like he had 10 years of therapy or something.
Right.
But then you don't know, is he aware of that awareness?
Right. So in my business, we would say he has an observing ego, a strong observing ego, which is not very consistent with what he also, with his lifestyle and what he does.
Right.
So it's like, what's wrong with him? If he knows that, because most people, if they're desperately trying to fit in, they wouldn't say, because I'm trying to fit in.
Right.
They would say something like,
what do you mean? I have to go work. I'm super important.
Right. Or, well, that's just what I like to do. This is what I feel like doing. They wouldn't say because they wanted to fit in, because as soon as they said that, they would go, oh, that sounds a little shallow, or it's supposed to be shallow, or something like that. Anyway, so I started thinking, I was trying to figure out what diagnosis to give him if he...
Reese Witherspoon.
Good job. That's not the diagnosis I would give him. I thought, is he narcissistic, okay? Because he definitely has narcissistic rage when he's challenged. He definitely needs to be seen a certain way. He needs to have he needs to be seated at the good table. He's walking into the restaurant. There's a voiceover and he says, I thought I wasn't going to get a good table.
I'm on the verge of tears as we arrive at a spot.
Oh my God.
For I am certain we will not have a table, but we do. And relief washes over me in an awesome wave.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's as if you've watched the movie a million times.
And it's funny because the book, there's a lot of moments in the movie that are very close to the moment in the book, but the wording in the book is a little different than that, and it's more awkward. So like, they cleaned it up a bit for the movie, and I like the movie version better.
So that experience of his is narcissistic. He is very, very concerned about being seated at a good table and how it looks to other people. And when he discovers that he is going to be sitting at a good table, he is extremely relieved. It's his primary focus in that moment. He's not focused on having a good meal.
I'm on the verge of tears. Right?
Yeah.
And I don't think he's being ironic.
Yeah. He also seems fearless, like he's above it all. He can challenge other people in ways that even narcissistic people wouldn't be able to do.
Because his fears have all to do with propriety and being misinterpreted or being seen a certain way, but not with things that most of the rest of us would be afraid of.
Like hurting someone's feelings.
Hurting someone's feelings or challenging authority or challenging, you know, something like that.
So what's the theory about the sheets with the blood on it that he's trying to get dry
clean? It's cran apple.
Yeah. Like, what's the theory behind that?
So meaning, like, if he didn't really kill these people, why does he have those sheets?
Yeah. Because at that point in the movie, he hasn't killed anybody yet, I don't think.
No, he did.
Oh.
Remember, those are the sheets after the girl he meets.
I don't
on the
think
street.
So. I think it's before that. It's before that. It's definitely before that. Oh, after the girl he
when
meets.
When he's walking down the street
and
he's like, hi. And she's like, hello.
Oh.
And then they walk across the street together. And the next day he's got these bloody sheets.
Okay.
And I think that's her head we see later or her hair or something like that.
I see.
Okay. So anyways,
that makes sense.
It's the implication is he killed that lady.
Right, right, right. So then he says to the Asian woman who works at the dry cleaners, who is not being very cooperative with him, he says, if you don't shut your mouth, I will kill you.
Right.
And she reacts to it.
Yeah.
Says something in Chinese.
But is it, and again, it's weird, right? Like he might have actually said that.
Yeah.
Did she understand that? Is she reacting to something else? Is
right,
he, you
right.
know, all these things.
Yeah. So he's watching porn casually, like porn is constantly on.
Yeah, that's a great scene, right? Because you hear the action, you think, oh, he's getting laid. And then it starts panning. You're like, oh, no, he's watching something. And he's doing sit-ups. And most of the noise is actually coming from him doing the sit-ups.
Yeah. He's having an affair. He's very cold and calculating. He doesn't seem to care about anybody. He is deciding on where to go to eat, and he's looking at the Zagat guide to figure out which is the best restaurant. Everything is about image. Everything about image.
Yeah. Oh, I love the Dorcia theme in the movie is great. Because first of all, we never see Dorcia, right?
Oh, I guess we don't.
No, we never do. And
we don't see the outside of Dorcia?
We don't see anything.
Oh.
And all we know is that it's like the in club or the in restaurant, right?
Yeah.
And it's so funny because remember with his secretary, where he's, you would think he wouldn't care so much what she thinks. She certainly doesn't care.
Yeah. He even cares about how she sees
right.
him. Because he's built this image of himself right. to everybody that can't be lived up to, of course.
And that part's really tragic because you kind of get the sense that she's actually a nice person.
Right.
She's the only, well, except for the Detective Kimball or whatever. But even he's a little odd. Like, she's almost like the only normal, rational person in this whole mess.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that she's into him. You would think she would see past all that bullshit.
Right.
But she doesn't.
Well, she does eventually, at the end. She's looking
Yes. That's a whole other level of fucked up. Like, it would fuck you up in the head to find that book.
Right. But she's, at the end, discovers his planner, and in it has all these horrible drawings.
Yeah,
of torturing women and this sort of thing.
Insane stuff.
And they show her crying. And the way I interpret it is that she is the one who deserves to really see him for who he really is because she's true of heart. And she's crying because she represents goodness and compassion. And
or at least normalness.
Normalness. But she seems even extra sensitive or something.
That's right.
And she reacts to this horror by crying and being sad about what Patrick Bateman is.
Because she looked up to him so much.
Yeah.
She had like this puppy crush on him, but a lot of it was like this admiration.
Well, she was pure goodness.
And she thought that
she accepts
right.
everything.
And she kind of assumed that he actually was competent somehow.
Yeah.
Right? Because she didn't. She covered for him a little bit, but she must have assumed, the impression I got was that she thought, oh, this guy must be really something, you know?
Right. Well, he was vice president after all.
Right.
And
we don't see him do one thing the whole time.
Right.
That has anything to do with anything.
Right. So, so now I think we might do well by introducing the theme of 80s materialism and capitalism, right? So he works for mergers and acquisitions, which was big in the 80s.
Price.
It's all about image and the suits and the nice restaurants, which was definitely a part of the 80s. And one of the things he does is he kills a homeless man who doesn't have a job and he humiliates him.
Do you know how bad you reek, Al? I mean, that scene was
get
one
a
of the
job, Al.
Right. That was one of the hardest ones
for me
to watch.
You have a negative attitude. So, you know, it's all about that sentiment that was in the 80s, you know, when you had all this excess and all, and there was all this, like, America, we're great. We have all this money and we're prosperous and da 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 da. And it's like, well, what about those who don't have a lot?
It's their fault, clearly.
It's their fault. They have a negative attitude.
Yeah.
They're not living the American dream because they're not doing anything about it. But of course, he's African American, and And the implication is that he's experienced racism and is down on his luck because of that.
And he, you know, and I looked at it like, even if he hadn't, let's say he was just a drunkard, right? Whatever. Like, up until that point, there is this part of him that almost really wants to kind of give the guy some, tough love, right? Like, come on, man, you can pull yourself up from your bootstraps. But the whole time, he's leading towards pulling out the knife and killing him. And it's just so doubly grotesque, right? The, like, I can't stand you. You know, like, you and I have nothing in common.
Right.
And then he just kills. And then he kills the dog. And so it's not just that he is a materialistic pig or whatever. He actually can't even stand that there's another reality.
Right. So one analysis that I would have for him that I didn't see in any of the literature that I saw written about the movie is that he is, through projective identification, trying to destroy parts of himself, but that he doesn't like, that are in conflict inside of him.
Sure.
It would be as his father works for, is the president or something, yeah, of that company, right?
Yeah.
So let's assume that his father is just as capitalist and just as narcissistic and maybe not very warm as a father.
Right.
And we would certainly imagine that Patrick Bateman grew up with not so great parents. His brother in
Sean
in
Rules of Attraction
had similar traits, not as bad, obviously.
Right. He's not a psychopath, but he's a sociopath.
and he had sensitivities.
Yeah.
You know, he had pain, and yeah, you know, he wanted, anyway. So Patrick Bateman obviously had some issues growing up, and he might have internalized this experience of being neglected, of being said he's not good enough, of being humiliated for not being perfect, not being a good enough son. And so he internalized this representation of this relationship where he has himself as being humiliated, himself as being not good enough, and this other person saying, I'm perfect and you're not.
Yeah.
And
right.
I can do anything and I'm rich and you're going to amount to nothing. You're nobody. And so
you can see the dad having abused him, not with a knife, but almost that extremely.
With capitalism. He was abused by capitalism. So he internalizes this. Now he has this internal representation of himself and the other. But the other is now a part of himself. That's
right.
that's the mechanism that in which we internalize our experiences growing up and the characteristics of our caregivers. And so in this interaction with the homeless person, why does he even seek out this homeless person? I mean, he could have easily just walked past. He probably walks past homeless people all the time. He's in New York, right?
Yeah.
And
well,
so,
and that's what I was saying. Like, I got the impression that there's these slivers of him that are all competing. It's almost like he's schizophrenic or something, right? Because there's this part of him that I really thought.
You mean multiple personalities?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this
people, just so you know, people often use schizophrenic in the non-clinical world. You lay people tend to use schizophrenic to mean multiple personalities.
Well, you know what's funny? Okay, let me tell you my brief anecdote about this.
Okay.
I never used to do that. I only started doing that because a few years ago, someone told me that schizophrenia was essentially multiple personality.
It's not true at all.
I always used to say multiple personality, and then someone corrected me.
It's actually technically dissociative identity disorder.
Well, whatever the fuck.
But schizophrenia is a whole other thing.
All right, listen. You're driving me schizophrenic, right? No, but basically what I'm thinking is there is a part of him that believed his own bullshit in that early moment of that interaction where he's like, I'm going to help this man. You know what I mean? But it quickly is overtaken by probably what you're saying. I kind of almost see it now that you're mentioning the father relationship and stuff. You can imagine his father physically and verbally abusing him as a kid. Like, you are never going to amount to it. You disgust me, all these things. And that takes over from what might have started from a quote-unquote good intention place.
Right. Well, in order to engage someone in projective identification, you have to engage them somehow.
Yeah.
If he just walked up to the homeless guy and said, you're nobody, what's wrong with you? The homeless guy would have rejected him somehow.
Right.
But he has to suck – people have to suck people in. So the idea is that when you have this internal representation at war with each other, so inside his psyche is this abused self and this other that is abusing him, but he possesses those qualities of being able to abuse other people and those motivations. And so this inner war is going on.
And he starts saying, I can help you.
Right. So he comes up. He has to find someone to project onto one of those sides so he can embody the other side. And it's sort of arbitrary depending on the situation, which side he'll identify with. But he tends to project the abused other onto other people. So he finds this homeless person and humiliates, first sucks him into the projective identity.
Because he's even I can help you. And the guy's like, you're so kind, mister. You're so kind.
Right. So now he's the needy, the helpless person, the person who is desperate for acceptance and love. And so now he can project that child of himself onto the homeless person and then proceed to say, oh, I can help you the way someone might in that position, and then proceed to abuse him and kill him.
But there's a flipping moment where he goes like, you and I, we've got nothing in common. And I feel like in that moment's where that he fully detaches emotionally from him being a human.
Right.
He's like, all right.
You're not even a human being.
Yeah.
And that statement of we have nothing in common is his very overt attempt to distance himself from a part of himself, which is that homeless person.
Right.
Which is desperate, which feels alone, which feels rejected, which feels... Right. Poor and destitute. There's a part of him that feels that way. So he projects this side on the homeless person and then proceeds to actually kill that person in an attempt to kill that part of himself.
Right.
And it feels good. It feels, because it's a fantasy that he actually is killing that part of himself. It feels good to him, but ultimately doesn't actually kill that part of himself, and he needs to go on killing. So not only does he doesn't find other homeless people in the movie, he finds primarily women, right? Which represent, in a misogynist culture, the weak part of the human race, right?
And he even finds like the even weaker, technically, is just like the lonely, nice person looking hooker.
Yeah.
All by herself, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't find the tough girl. He finds the mousy one.
Yes.
And he continues to, through projective identification, try to rid himself of the female side of him, of the accepting side of him, of the side of him that wants to give to someone else.
And I got the sense that he had some homosexual struggle inside of himself, because for two reasons. One, like, he hates these women so much for some reason, right? But two, his reaction to Lewis, because it's so extreme, right? Now, you could say
Lewis was a gay man.
Yeah, Lewis is definitely gay, and he has
But he's in the closet, which is also a very 80s.
But it's very common for them to be in the closet in the 80s. Sure. But whatever the case may be, he is in love with Patrick. He loves the guy.
Yeah.
And he at one point thinks he gets that message, right? Which is not what Patrick's at least consciously trying to do. But he is so disgusted, so extremely repulsed and bothered by the moment, that I couldn't help but wonder, is he closeting something there? Like, you know, is he a little bit?
And I mean, going off the theory that he was possibly at least somewhat homosexual.
Right.
And again, through projective identification, since homosexuality represents all things weak, all things horrible to him and his father and society at the time, he rids himself of that part of himself by projecting it onto Lewis and killing him. Doesn't he kill him too?
He doesn't kill Lewis. He tries to kill him. He goes, starts strangling him. And, you know, he grabs him with the gloves. He's like, Patrick, what are you, you know, but then he starts kissing the glove because he thinks he's coming onto him, because he can't really go through with it. Yeah. And then that's when he washes the gloves off and leaves. Yeah. And he's so terrified of that moment.
Yeah, yeah,
he's so scared of that, and he can't actually go through and kill him.
So other things in the 80s, they played Huey Lewis, the 4 album, which they played Hip to Be Square, right?
Yes.
Which is probably the point where I thought that Huey Lewis actually became a bad band.
Oh, really?
I didn't say that very well. That's the point where Huey Lewis
Jumped the shark.
jumped the shark. You know, because their previous album was Sports was good, and their album before that I thought was pretty good. But Hip to Be Square was...
Hip to Be Square!
Such a bad song. And I remember that song was huge because it was their next hit after their humongous album. And I remember the video, and I just remember thinking, like, I'm supposed to like this. It's sort of like when you went to see Phantom Menace. Anyway.
All right, right. And then so you like convince yourself, like, I like this.
Yeah. And then that other song, we're so happy to be stuck with you.
Oh, I never did like that one. I love Power of Love, though, because of Back to the Future.
Yeah. Well, that was sports. And so...
But that moment in the movie is fantastic because, in fact, he is talking about sports, but then he plays. Yeah. And this is his next, you know.
He did the same thing with Phil Collins. He said that, I believe that Invisible Touch is Genesis, the Genesis masterpiece. And I'm just like, that's, again, when Genesis became a sellout band just trying to make crappy pop music.
But that was kind of like his shtick. And I don't think it was on... I think he misinterpreted things.
Yeah.
Because... When he started appreciating it is when, in fact, it becomes fakely emotional.
Oh.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like, because he doesn't have real emotion.
When things became plastic, but also
like,
very... But very,
that makes sense.
But very popular.
Right.
That's when he started liking
it. That makes sense, yes.
Yeah.
But he clearly has the capacity for critiquing and all these kind
of
things.
No, he doesn't. He's quoting newspapers.
No. I'm thinking more about like... Well, actually, you may be right in general, because I'm thinking, especially in the book, he talks about all the fashion and the brands and the things and the stuff.
I mean, he never says anything along those lines.
None of his original thoughts then?
No, I think he's quoting right out of a critique.
Oh, that is, I could see that, because he says, New York Matinee calls it a playful little dish. Remember
who talks like that? No one talks like that.
Okay, so that's actually a good observation, because the way I looked at it was, that I felt like he's got the capacity to talk about it, but his conclusions are all wrong.
All of his
opinions are from other people.
Right. And you notice that one woman who's sort of the posh drunk girl,
right.
he's listening to Whitney Houston, The Greatest Love of All, and he's going on one of those rants where he's just basically quoting a critic.
Right.
And she starts laughing at him. She says, you actually listen to Whitney? You have Whitney Houston CDs in your apartment? Is that what you're...
More than one?
Is that what you're saying?
She's like, you like Whitney Houston? Yeah. No, but then it's interesting. He can't impress her the same way he can impress, like, the... he can freak a lot of people out.
Because she actually is in his social class.
Yeah.
And isn't impressed the way everyone else is.
And she sees through the BS a bit.
But she also wants to please him. You can tell she lets a lot go.
Well, she likes him.
Yeah.
He's an attractive guy, so she... But I don't get
But I think it's also that misogyny in that culture. Mm. Because the whole thing about the movie is he's never charming, he's never interesting, he's never nice to people.
Well, like the heartbreaking moment for me, well, one of the many, remember, so they're with the supermodels in the club, right? Or they're not supermodels, the models.
Right.
And then he's being a dick, right? They leave the club. What does she say? There's something sweet about you.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh,
yeah, right?
That's so heartbreaking.
Right, because, again, in the 80s and in our culture today, but particularly in the past, in our sexist culture, you would have people forgiving men for... What is my cat doing?
I don't know. There's some black pellet on the floor.
Oh, can you pick up that piece of paper? Because I think it's an attractive nuisance.
Yes, and so even in his... Like, totally uninteresting. He's a total bore, right? And they go outside.
But because he's an attractive white male with a lot of power and money.
There's something sweet about you.
He gets everything.
Right.
That's all you need is those trappings. You don't need to be a good person.
Right.
You don't need to be interesting. You get everything in the world if you were born in the right place and wear the right suits. Another thing I noticed about the 80s was answering machines. Do you remember with actual tapes
Hi,
in them?
It's Paul. I'm going to be out of town for a few days.
Yeah. And then Lady in Red, the song comes on.
Yes,
God,
that
was such a big song. Big cell phones. another thing from the 80s was suspenders. I actually had suspenders in the 80s, yeah.
I must have too.
Yeah. Phil Collins again. Another thing I noticed from the 80s was in his stereo in his condo, he has a big equalizer component with separate left and right channels.
Oh, right.
I mean, why in the world would you ever want to raise one particular band?
Because you're that discerning.
just in the left channel.
Hey, man, you got to equalize your room just right.
I mean, do you remember those? Those were ubiquitous in late 80s stereos, was to have a 20 band left and right EQ component.
We didn't have a video hi-fi yet. So I think the equivalent of like the HDTVs and the stuff was all the hi-fi audio stuff.
Right, which was complete BS.
Yeah.
My dad had one of those. And every time I would go home, I would find every single band maxed out all the way at the top.
Just like a volume.
I know. And I was like, Dad, you realize that if you just put it all at zero and turn up the volume, it'll, you know what I mean? And I'd always go, Dad, stop that. And I'd put it all down. And I'd say, like, that's not, why have this here? And he'd go like, oh, okay. Well, thanks, Kirk.
It's funny because he's an engineer.
No, he's not. He's a graphic artist.
Oh, I'm sorry. But he works at Boeing. So
but he's a graphic artist. Okay. Yeah. So then I leave, and then I come back, and they'd all be pegged at 10 again. And I'd go, Dad, come on. So anyway.
That's hilarious.
So how many of these ultra-sensitive, multi-band, left and right EQ components were just being wasted on people? You know what I mean?
Well, they probably weren't that sensitive.
Right.
Well, okay. So here's a question. In the book, have you read the book?
No.
So in the book, it's a little more explicit that basically nothing really happened other than in his head. But in the movie, I feel like there's more room for interpretation. Because, so remember when he goes back to the apartment and it's empty and the lady, the real estate lady is there? When she tells him to go and never come back, I feel an implication there. Like, it could just be that she's afraid of who is this weirdo. Here's the other implication I got. The real estate folks, they're so depraved that they don't care that there was a murder there. They just care that people don't find out.
Right, because it was recently painted.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I was like, wait, so did something happen there?
Oh.
And in the book, there's more detail about, so he does do a lot of weird shit with animals too and stuff like that. So there is the possibility that he does do some crazy whacked out stuff, but maybe didn't murder all those people.
Right.
Because Paul Allen, for example, theoretically still alive, right?
Right. But we never really get confirmation of that.
That's true. But then the cops were never really after him.
Yeah. But are the cops 80s cops who don't care about anything like everyone else?
Right. So, but then, you know, he shows up at the club. Everything's fine. Everyone's like, huh? Oh, Jesus, that was you. That was hilarious, right?
Yeah.
He's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
And then he calls the secretary. What's her name?
Chloe Savannah.
Yeah, yeah. But what's the, in the, I can't believe I forgot her. Character's
April
name.
April or something?
No. And he calls and he's like, ah. He's like, why? He's like trying to tell her like everything's wrong or whatever, right? It's like, why are you so worried? And he's just like flipping out.
Yeah. Right. So all of that is interesting psychologically and diagnostically. If he was hallucinating everything, he definitely was becoming more and more symptomatic as the movie progressed.
Right.
And he becomes more confused and his emotions start becoming more erratic. Honestly, to cut to the chase, I don't think he fits any diagnosis. There's a possibility of a delusional disorder that's developing, some psychotic disorder, I mean, like schizophrenia or bipolar. He definitely could have been experiencing a manic episode, but it's unclear because a lot of the things that he's doing don't fit nicely into a diagnostic category. In the paper that I sent you and that, you know, we can talk about, they talked about him maybe having schizotypal or schizotypal personality disorder. And I've treated people with that disorder and he doesn't fit that description at all to me. Hmm. They also thought he might be borderline. And again, no, it just doesn't
but
fit.
It's really hard because he's an amalgamation.
Right.
A fictional narrative amalgamation.
Right.
And
it'd be very hard to find someone like this.
Yeah.
That exhibited
that extreme. Because he was almost really a metaphor for it all.
Right.
You know?
I mean, before any of the murders, I would have said maybe narcissistic, maybe a trauma survivor.
Right.
Or an attachment problem, because he definitely wasn't exhibiting secure attachment behaviors with other people. Didn't seem to care or think he cared. But then when he starts to hallucinate and starts to kill all these people, then I started not knowing what category to put him in.
Yeah. There's that moment, which I really love. It's towards the end. He gets back to the bar and there's all his friends. Like, nothing's ever happened. Nothing. And he sits down and he's sweating profusely. And then Bryce is back, right? Or Price, whatever, right? And they're looking at Reagan on the TV. He's like, God, how can he sit there and lie like that, right? And how can he be just so so cool about it. And then
he's lying about the Iran-Contra.
Yeah, yeah. And then and then Bateman goes into his monologue and he's like, you know, he talks about like this confession has meant nothing. Mm. And that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's just so great because there's no catharsis. He's like, there's no catharsis. And that was kind of the most maybe real moment for me in the movie, because if you actually take it as, no, he's not really killing people. He's just an egotistical prick from Wall Street with too much money, too much free time. And he is somewhat deranged because no one draws stuff like that in their book daily without a little bit of messed up in the head, right? And he's clearly antisocial personality disorder to a certain extent because he doesn't give a shit about anything.
Right. Right. That should be mentioned. Antisocial psychopath, right. Definitely a candidate for
right.
that.
But then at the end, you get that sense of like, he actually was trying to kind of kill himself in the process, like commit himself, right? By doing the full out confession, right? Because he leaves this long message, and I killed him, and I killed hookers,
right.
And I even ate a little bit.
So that's why I think he suffered from a very difficult childhood, and that's the primary reason,
right.
For all of the behavior, because he seemed to be very sad and very upset about being caught, and he didn't.
And
have
he's finally
to,
turning it in.
Yeah, and he's expressing emotion. He's
right.
crying, and he almost feels he really wants someone to
that's
know.
That's right. And then there's that super vulnerable moment where he's doing all that, but then by the end, he goes back to this cold self, and he's like, this confession has meant nothing.
Because the person the person he confessed to said, no, you didn't.
The society around him doesn't even care.
they don't want to hear it. Yes. Yeah. So what are your theories as to why people like this movie? Because on its surface, it doesn't seem like a likable movie, right? You have a very unlikable person who is doing a lot of unlikable things, a lot of horrible things to people. The good person in the film gets crapped on all the time.
Right.
There's nothing warm-hearted about the movie at all.
Right.
So nothing good happens. Why do people like a movie like this?
I mean, there must be different segments. Some of it might be fans of Bret Easton Ellis, right? So there's a portion of folks there.
But why would there be fans of this author? I've heard the book is even worse.
The book is. But, you know, let's say that you liked Less Than Zero, and you read his book, and you had read Glamorama or something. Like, let's say you were reading his books, right? You like his writing style.
No.
So that's one class. I'm just saying that's one class of people that would
most like people have not read the book. I mean, I would say of the vast majority of the fans of the movie,
that could be.
They haven't read the book.
Okay, well then, I guess I'd go back to why me and my friends liked it, because we hadn't read the book. And it was, stylistically, it was very well done. It just really, really deliberate.
Yeah.
Like every scene was really, you didn't have fat in there.
Yeah.
You know? And, literally. And then also, the characters are so entertaining to watch. The comedy of errors around it, the sheer absurdity of it all is like watching a train wreck, right? So that's very entertaining to watch as well.
Watching a train wreck.
And then there is the parody of, or the satire about the 80s, right? And right. if you grew up in the 80s,
right.
that's very entertaining.
I can
as
comment
well.
To that because when did the movie come out?
2000.
2000?
2001, maybe. 2000.
I mean, when I watched it, the 80s were just 10 years, 12 right. years before that.
Right.
But when I watched it, I remember it was one of the first movies or depictions of the 80s that I had seen. Because it takes a while for enough time to pass for a depiction to actually seem different, right?
To have retrospect, yeah.
Right. And I remember watching that movie and just being transported, even though it was only 10 years earlier,
yeah. right.
and thinking, oh my God, they really nailed the 80s
right.
in so many different ways. I mean, not the 80s is the way all of us experienced
no.
it, but definite parts of it.
It was late 80s anyways, but yeah.
Yeah. Like Sussudio when
yeah.
they played because
Sussudio
that song I don't think has been played since the 80s. You know, no one listens to that song. No one says I want to listen to Sussudio. But in 1988 or whatever, when that song was popular, it was humongously popular. And so to hear that song again, I just think, oh, that's right, that song was huge. So yeah, I think it is sort of entertaining to watch a period piece.
They had good actors. I mean, they freaking had, what's his name as the detective, whom I love.
Yeah.
The Green Goblin.
Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe.
Yeah. And even his buddies, all of them are famous now.
Yeah, they're all good. And many of them have moved on to do great things. And,
right. Well, here are my ideas as to why people love the movie. And you tell me if this is true. Other ideas that you didn't mention. I think you get a vicarious thrill from being able to punish the yuppies, because a lot of the yuppies are being punished by him, and he's punishing himself. And I think a lot of people want the yuppies to be punished. I mean, one thing that I think people that didn't grow up in the 80s might not know is that everyone hated the yuppies. They hated this class of people. The young, what would they call it? Young up-and-comer, young, I don't know the way.
Billionaires Boys Club.
Yeah, something like that. It was like these rich people who had it all, and they had all the nice things, and most of us did not have that.
Right.
And so we hated these people.
I don't know if it's that they're being punished. They're certainly being made fun of.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's that. And then there's the other vicarious thrill of being able to kill people that annoy us, or just being able to kill people. And before watching this movie, if you would have asked me, well, what's your position on everyone having a desire to kill people? I would have said, I know Freud had a theory about death, you know, the death wish, and there's all these people who have all these theories about, and then, you know, the id wanting to destroy people, and I don't know. I'd like to think that people are good. So my pendulum kind of swings back and forth. Well, after watching this movie and knowing that it's a very popular movie, the pendulum has swung all the way over to the side where I believe that we, or at least a lot of us, have a innate id desire to destroy other people, this wish to kill people that annoy us, and that we will suppress that because our superego and the society actually suppress it for good reasons. And that this movie gives us that thrill. It allows us to express that wish. What do you think?
I feel like it's a valid theory. It wasn't my experience, except in the preamble to a couple of moments, like when he says, "Try getting a reservation at Dorsia now, you stupid bastard," or whatever, and then he slams. But that's the only, like, that moment, that's that line, because it's funny. And the things surrounding the murders are presented either humorously or very stylistically, so that's entertaining. But for me, it's a little weird because I get very empathetic when I'm watching murders, and unless it's really like I'm watching if it's a slasher movie, like I'm watching Halloween, then I don't really care because that's the point of the movie.
Right. Well, there's a part of you that cares, obviously. That means you're human. But there's also possibly a part of you that is subconsciously getting off on watching the killing of human beings.
Maybe that's true. Yeah, maybe. I remember it was more like we've talked about this before. I've been fascinated with serial killers, right? But it's a morbid fascination from the perspective of like, how can something go so wrong, you know?
Well, let me ask you this. when you watch the movie, do you hope that he gets caught by the detective? Are you hoping that the detective will catch him?
No. No.
Right. I don't think anyone who likes the movie is hoping the detective will catch him. I think everyone hopes Patrick Bateman will get away with it.
Yes.
Why do we want that? Why do we want someone to get away with it? I think it's because we're projecting all of our id wishes that we have to suppress onto Patrick Bateman. One of the things that I read about that someone else is writing, which I agree with, is that Patrick Bateman represents pure id, this just unbridled id. He has sex. He is narcissistic. He looks at himself in the mirror. He flexes. He tells people to do things. He kills people that annoy him. He yells at people. He isn't nice to people. He gets everything he wants. He takes money. He takes everything. And one could say that we all have that selfish wish. We all have that wish to just let go and be selfish and to hurt people we want to hurt and to take what we want to take. And he represents that in a very distinct way, well-rounded way for an hour and 40 minutes. And I think that we as watchers get to vicariously have our wishes met through Patrick Bateman.
I will say that I experienced that more with Sean Bateman in the other movie, The Rules of Attraction. I certainly had that feeling. Actually, and even with his friend who travels Europe, and you see that quick montage of him going through Europe and partying like crazy.
That's not Sean.
No, it's his friend. It's Sean's friend. I had that moment of like, oh, that seems so cool. I want to do that, right? And even with Sean Bateman, I'm like, he's kind of neat. I mean, he's a jerk, but I kind of want to live that life vicariously, right?
Yeah.
With Patrick Bateman, I honestly, you know what gets in the way for me is I feel like this incredible like sadness at the same time for how tortured he tortures himself. Like how much anguish over the little things and everything. His life seems so painful every day.
Right. You're having empathy for right. for the id inside right. of you right. that wants these things and is torturing itself.
Perhaps. you twisted my meaning.
another thing that's sort of a variation of what I'm saying. I mean, well, let me ask you this before I say this. What's the gender distribution of those who love this movie, do you think?
I must be largely male.
Right. I would say 99% male. I don't know a single woman who would...
I have met females that like it, but...
Like it, but not love it, right?
Well, if they love it, they're not your average females.
Okay. Well, I would say, why is that, you know? So one answer that I have is that it allows men to enact their hidden hatred of women. I mean, not that all men hate women, but... If you have a hatred of women or have been hurt by women or have been frustrated by women throughout one's life and maybe have a inferiority problem or a power problem, it would perhaps satisfy a wish to destroy women, because the movie definitely puts down women. Not only does he murder women, but he humiliates them, he manipulates them, he doesn't care. He breaks up with his fiance and says something like, well, Evelyn, I just don't really care about you. And he disregards them, he uses them as objects. If you had a problem with women, this would definitely satisfy some of your wishes to do bad things to women. What do you think?
I feel like I have a friend that probably when they saw this movie had all those feelings and maybe laughed at those moments unironically, because he felt, that's right, bitch.
Right.
And maybe this is why I love the movie so much. I feel like I actually get the character's irony, and that's what I really enjoy about it. And so, like, in all those moments, whenever he's doing all those things, I do laugh, and I do think it's hilarious with him naked with the chainsaw down the hallway. But in spite of what's actually happening, right? Like, what's actually being implied. And, like, when he's holding the nail gun behind the head of his secretary, right? Like, I find that scene humorous. Well, but if in its reality, it's a monstrous situation, you know?
If I might ask you some questions. I know you to be a very nice person and very nonviolent person. I can't think of a time where you would have ever physically hurt someone or physically intimidated or made someone to feel...
Only when I was really drunk.
Even then,
it's been ugly.
Sexually.
No. And there was an episode where I intimidated a homeless man when I was really drunk.
Oh. Well, when you're really, really drunk, well, but when you're normal, you don't even hint at any kind of intimidation to people, don't think.
That's fair.
Yeah. I mean, maybe people
might
be... But
ironically, like, the episode I'm thinking of was actually a bit like the Patrick thing we were talking about, because it started off with me trying to help this person and started talking to him, but he was not well. He had some disease mentally, so his reality was very, very confused. And I was very drunk, and since I couldn't get him, like, to react the right way or whatever, I started getting upset. And then I started projecting my father onto him, because I'm like, you, how can you be so helpless with her? And then I started getting like really angry at him and getting in his face and like yelling some crazy things. And he started like running away from me, and I chased him for blocks.
Whoa.
I'm serious. I'm not like making this shit up. This is years and years ago, but
what was that night?
I don't remember, but it was a really weird night. And it was really dangerous. I mean, I could have died in any number of ways that night.
Yeah.
But
so in that situation, we could say you definitely played out an issue from your childhood in relation to your father, in how he can act incompetent and he's right. He doesn't do well with money, and he's...
Yeah, the helplessness was the... And it was, again, in this case where it started with me, quote unquote, I want to help this person.
Right.
And it ended with me, like, probably damaging them even worse.
Right.
Psychologically.
So the idea is possibly you were projecting a helpless part onto him that you've actually internalized from your father.
Right.
and you were trying to rid yourself of that by attacking it in someone else. And because you were so intoxicated, you couldn't modulate your behavior in a way that would be more functional.
Right.
Yeah. But in general, I would say you're definitely not like Patrick Bateman.
Not normally, no.
I mean, I would say you're almost the direct opposite. However, might it be possible that you have impulses, like anyone else, of anger that don't get expressed, that a movie like this might feel like you're able to express through the character of Patrick Bateman?
I mean, I definitely experienced that with some movies, like Falling Down. Remember Falling Down? Oh, man, I can so relate to Michael Douglas. Yeah. Oh, goddammit. Certainly stuff like Die Hard or... I mean, there's a billion movies where I can't relate so much.
Right, right. So
the anger.
Right.
Hulk.
Yeah. So with Patrick Bateman, there's a part of your superego that is saying, you can't consciously relate to this character, but you will be attracted to it because it will provide you with a catharsis of violence that you need to have met for you.
Could be.
In other movies, I'll allow you to consciously relate and identify with this person because it's socially acceptable to identify with the Falling Down character because he's not a sadistic, misogynistic, capitalistic, horrible person, right? He's just a guy trying to go home from work and everything's getting in his way. Whereas a Patrick Bateman character, you know, and everyone knows, you're not supposed to like or identify with this character. You're supposed to dislike him. But one might be attracted to his behavior as a way of trying to get a lot of these impulses out through a socially acceptable way, like laughing at a movie, laughing at the moments that he slashes people, that sort of thing.
That's true. Okay, another example, like Lestat from Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, yeah.
So certainly an aspirational type of thing, even though he's this murderous vampire.
Yeah, I mean, it explains... a lot of movies and a lot of violence in movies.
But I still feel like I come back to a block with Bateman because it's like Norman Bates from Psycho in a way. It's hard for me to have that same feeling with someone like that because I guess I see them more as like a victim. It sounds crazy, but it's almost clearly if someone kills someone, like the victim is the dead person. But when you're seeing the movie and a lot of these characters are so messed up, they're so like not normal that I can't help but feel sadness for that, right?
Yeah.
And it's really hard.
It's complicated.
Right.
You have lots of feelings.
Right. And it's really hard in that moment for me to see past that part. Now, you're right that subconsciously that may be there, but consciously when I'm watching American Psycho, I mostly feel the sadness and the hilariousness or the absurdity, I guess, of the whole thing.
Right.
The parts that I did aspirationally see, where like you were mentioning, like, oh, that's really cool. He's got a really nice shower and look at all those fancy scrubs he uses and stuff. And that does look like a nice floor on his apartment.
He's unabashedly narcissistic about the way he looks and his things.
Right.
It's like this ultra self-conscious, superficial person. And it allows us to have permission to be in that direction when we see. And the funny thing is when that movie came out in 2000 or 2001, I remember just thinking, whoa, he is over the top with those facial creams and the working out and the stretching and the yoga. And today it's not so different anymore. When I watched it last night, I had a different reaction to Patrick Bateman and his regimen.
Because you're in the middle of one of your regimens.
Because, well, actually, I did have a facial the other day. Because I thought, actually, those are kind of normal behaviors today.
Yeah.
Whereas back in 2000...
Metro was not really done in 2000.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're definitely more decadent now. You know, the amount of spas and the facials and the waxing and the, you know, what did I say? There I say massages.
Yeah.
As we become more wealthy, we definitely pamper ourselves more. I mean, can you imagine our parents going to a spa and getting massages and getting facials? I just can't imagine that.
I think I know where the block comes from. I have a visceral, adverse hatred reaction to any situation that depicts abuse of the weak. And I think it comes from growing up in Bogota, in Colombia, when I did, in that time frame, as well as probably a little bit of my own personal like family history or whatever. It's like, I just feel like anytime I watch a movie, no matter what the movie is, if there is a bully or an abusive situation, I cannot get that. I cannot even relate or sympathize at all, right? But so American Psycho is a very interesting amalgamation of things for me, because in the moments when he is bullying, I lose any ability to empathize. Like when he's killing the homeless man, or when he's killing the cat, or any of these like obvious bully moments, right? But when he is being ridiculous with his creams or his little card things, I find all those moments either hilarious or in some cases somewhat desirable in like, oh, I want money, I want limousines, I want these kind of things.
Right.
And then certainly there's some killing moments that are hilarious because he's naked with tennis shoes and a chainsaw, and he is wearing a plastic overcoat while he's listening to Huey Lewis and swinging a big ass fire axe, right? So there's these moments that are like so absurd that are
right. So are funny. I would contend that packaged in it, because imagine the movie without the 80s, without the absurdities,
right,
without some of the humor. Imagine a movie like that. It would be terrible, right? So I contend that when you package a cathartic, murderous person within a lot of entertainment and gloss, then it is the perfect combination for people, because they have an excuse to watch what they wish to do upon other people, but at the same time can say the things that you're saying, which is, well, I'm only liking it because it's absurd. Well, I'm only liking it because it was about the 80s. Well, I'm only liking it because it's just silly.
Well,
because we couldn't accept just watching a straight up horrible, realistic movie about someone killing other people and bullying them, you know? Because we have a heart, and
like,
we don't.
Do you remember Irreversible?
Yeah.
That's a hard movie to watch, right?
Oh.
But so using your theory, you could say, well, there's maybe part of us that wants those moments.
Yeah.
Wants to bash the skull in.
I think it's true.
But I think that's true only in the sense that those capacities exist within the human brain.
Right.
I think they're pretty deeply buried for most of us.
Right.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, they are. I mean, most people don't do those things.
I'll tell you what. Have you seen Human Centipede?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So I watched The Human Centipede, and I
do you think I would like that movie?
I think it's enjoyable if you understand that it's ridiculous. I really enjoyed Human Centipede because it's so over the top and ridiculous and funny in a way. It's.
I mean, I would probably like watching it with you or other people because we could laugh, but just by myself, I don't imagine that I would like it.
But I'll tell you what, I tried to watch Human Centipede 2, and in years past, I would have been able to watch it. I had to stop it because I had that problem with it. It's in black and white. The premise is that it's a dude that watched Human Centipede 1 over and over obsessively and is already psychotic anyway. It starts killing. But it was not glamorous at all, and it was very, like, the murderer himself and the murderers and the way it's presented, it was very almost like you're watching it through a camera in a garage. In fact, they have that.
So this is along the lines of my theory that if you package it within entertainment trappings, it allows you to have all that cathartic satisfaction while being able to allow your conscious mind to think you like it for another reason.
Could be.
You know? Which makes me think about a lot of violence in movies and why we might be so attracted to it, you know?
That could be. Certainly, I mean, it's violence as entertainment is very old in our culture.
Yeah. All right. Let's see if there's anything more. Do you have anything more?
We never really talked about the relationship between him and Kimball, the detective, which is a fascinating relationship, right? Because Kimball comes in all of a sudden as a reality wave, right? Like, hey, man, I'm investigating. Right. And so at first you kind of get the sense of like, oh, everything's going to catch up to him. But you get the sense that Kimball starts almost like he rides this fine line between at first he's being just pleasant, say, oh, I know how busy you guys can get, but I think he knows that it's full of shit. Right. But then he almost starts kind of liking the glamour of being around these people. And by the end, he's like, oh, it's fine. I checked with your buddies. Everything checks out. Right.
So is the implication that he's trying to protect Patrick?
I know. I didn't get that. I actually got the implication that I got was that he knows there's something not right with Patrick.
Yeah, he definitely seems to become enamored with him.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's just this comment on how everyone in the 80s was desirous of the yuppie lifestyle. One of the things that was in the article, and I should provide the title, it's called Examining the Personality of Patrick Bateman of American Psycho, written by Christopher Schaefer of Walden University.
Wow.
And one of the things that he brought up that I thought was actually interesting was that Patrick Bateman is actualizing. So there's a humanistic psychology idea of self-actualization where as you have all of your needs met on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the final need that you pursue is the need for self-actualization. And it took me probably 15 years to figure out what self-actualization means. It literally means the actualization of the self, which is a big duh, but somehow it took me 15 years to figure that out. So, which is, it's sort of a interesting philosophy in that we are not ourselves at times when we're stressed, and that as we become more stable in our life, we actually have the freedom to actualize ourself as if there was some self in us, innate thing. It's an innate thing that we can work towards actualizing and making real. So, for instance, with someone, they might want to become more authentic, or they might want to become more artistic, or they might want to become more assertive or something. Well, the dark side to this is that if inside of you, yourself is a horrible, murderous, narcissistic, selfish person, then as all of your needs are being met, you can actualize that self. Right. And so what this writer was saying was that because Bateman had all of his needs met, he had all the, he had, you know, his home, his, the money, he had all the friends, he had a stable job, he had his health, he had the perfect body, he had everything he needed, he had fun in his life. The last thing on the list was to actualize the self. And in order to do that, he needed to start killing people and he needed to start really abusing people. And I just thought that was an interesting idea.
Well, it's kind of like the Roman emperors or something to say, hey, here's this emperor. Money is irrelevant. Like, the idea of money is pointless because anything they want, anything can be got. And they have control over all the known world. They can kill people at will. So what is left for them to desire? And then you have all those horror stories of what they would do, right?
Yeah.
These crazy orgies or crazy massacres or crazy over-the-top things because they just couldn't do more. They're like, now what?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But then I wonder, and maybe it is, maybe it's that because their inner self was messed up, right? Because you have all these modern billionaires, and some are wacky, but some are trying to do good, and some are trying to do, you know, so it's not, it doesn't seem like just because you attain a certain level of success, you then become a psychopath.
Well, no, the idea is that you become right. Who you are.
And it happened that Patrick Bateman was a psychopath.
Right, which seems to be in line with observation of people. You know, you find that some people become very mean to people, whereas most people become perhaps more philanthropic or...
It's almost like a different interpretation of the old adage of like power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? But maybe it's that the more likely folks to earn the power might be psychopaths.
Well, and another theory is that as you become more stable and have more power, you are able to enact the things that you always wanted to enact. And if you always wanted to become murderous of people, then that's what ends up happening.
Yeah, and then that's what I mean is like, because you look at throughout history, and yeah, I think maybe on balance, more rulers and more powerful people did evil things, quote unquote. But maybe it's because it took to be an evil person to start with to get to those positions of power more often than not.
Right. Because in order to do what they wanted to do, they had to have power. Whereas if you're a loving, giving person, you don't necessarily need a bunch of power in order to give to those around you.
And you sometimes, especially it used to be, but it's still quite a bit the case, that you had to be willing to step over anyone to get to those positions of power.
Yeah.
And even today, I mean, like, why is it that so many politicians end up having these scandals of, like, they did terrible things, right?
Yeah.
And then you, a lot of the Enron, all the Wall Street stuff. I'm reading The Wolf of Wall Street right now, The Wolf of Wall Street. And it's that kind of crazy over the top debauchery and lack of care for humanity.
Right. So is it that those people were born that way or had a childhood that produced that kind of behavior and those kinds of impulses? Or does the power make them that way? Or does our society reward people for that? You know, for the Enron people, if they had a woman, an old woman with her retirement fund standing in front of them crying as they took money out of her hands and she slowly went into poverty before their eyes,
right,
they probably wouldn't have done it. But when you're just dealing with numbers on a screen, you don't right. have the empathy that you would normally, unless you really force yourself to have that empathy. It's the same thing. It's just always bizarre. And I know everyone talks, or many people have talked about it before, but right now, there are horrible things happening to humans around the planet.
Right.
And yet, if one tiny thing happens to someone in your town, everyone flips out.
Right.
Why is that? I mean, it could be argued that you believe it might happen to you because it's closer to home, but I actually think it's because we just don't, we can't relate. They're too distant, and it doesn't feel real to us.
Hurricane, right?
Right, in the Philippines.
Yes.
Like, how many tens of thousands? I mean, how many people died?
Like, ridiculous amounts, and homeless like crazy. It's still a problem.
It's still a massive problem. How many Americans are actually thinking about this?
Yeah.
I mean, there are Americans. I know people that are thinking about it.
But it happens even within this country, right? Like, you'll have, then we have some massive disaster.
I avoid the news because it's depressing to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know how we got on the topic. But.
Well, we got onto it because, like, we don't see it out of sight, out of mind, and it's not as relatable.
Right.
Whereas if your point with Wall Street is, like, if you see the damage
right.
happening in real time in front of your eyes.
Yeah. I mean, for most people, if someone trips and falls and hurts themselves, no matter who they are, they'll feel compassion and,
for the most part, yeah.
and reach out and say, oh my God, are you okay? And yet you have these people that will press a button and kill thousands of people.
But and then you have stuff like this. Like, I went to see a movie with some friends, and there's this guy I know. He's not like a close friend, but he's a very unfeeling person. And I was talking about how Paul Walker, the Fast and the Furious guy, died. And he hadn't heard, but I'm like, yeah, he died. And his response was, oh, good, so they don't make any more of those crappy movies. I didn't say anything, but I was like, that's an example of what you're talking. This is a human being that died in a fire, like viciously died. Like, terrible, horrible. And it's been reduced to like this offhanded, because it's so distant, it feels so unreal.
Yeah.
He's this guy on a TV screen, on a movie screen.
Yeah. The thing that reminds me of is 9/11. The day that it happened, 9/11 was a weekday, right? Do you remember what day of the week it was? It was in the middle of the week.
It was like Tuesday, I think.
And I was working as a therapist. And one of the clients that I worked with later that day was a family that had a number of kids in it. And they were all abuzz about 9/11 because it was definitely in the air, right? And they were saying, oh man, I hope a plane hits my school because I don't want to go to school tomorrow. And jeez. I was so devastated by 9/11 and the news reports. And I was in such a low, traumatized, literally, place that when they said that, I was stunned. And right. I can still remember it. And it was, what, 12 years ago. And that was when I realized that depending on how old you are, you're empathy and your moral development might be at a lesser stage.
Yep.
You just don't have those brain pathways or the maturity or whatever you want to call it that allows you to feel the way that adults feel. And I feel like even as I get older, 43 right now, I have even more empathy than I did 10, 20 years ago.
Sure.
Actually, a listener wrote in about this very topic and said that there was some research showing that actual circuitry in the brain that is associated with morality is not fully developed until like 25.
Huh.
The same pathway that's probably involved in the prefrontal cortex, if not that very one. And so when you have 12-year-olds talking about wanting planes to run into their school, they just don't have that ability to empathize with the people that have died or the people that would die in the same way an adult would.
Yeah.
So maybe some people don't have that as developed as other people do.
But then you even get to this point of like adults, fully grown, 50-year-olds, whatever. And you see a lot of the comments that came out with the Trayvon thing. And then, you know, everyone was like, oh, well, he had the riot because the guns, because the things. It was very politicized, right? But what I don't, what I just can't wrap my head around is like, at the end of the day, no matter what, like a 17-year-old kid is dead. He died. Like he is dead. He's not coming back.
Yeah.
But these adults couldn't get past the part of, oh, stand your ground law or this or the other, whatever statement, to have a little empathy for that fact. So, well, he's a thug. It's like, even if he's quote unquote a thug, whatever that means, right? Like he's a 17-year-old. How many 17-year-old kids don't fall under the category of thuggish?
Well, I know that that is a valid criticism of people's reactions to news stories like that. But I think that these kinds of stories, I mean, how many murders happened on that particular day in the world? I mean, we're talking hundreds, you know, if not thousands, right? Well, why was that one so interesting to people? And I think that's really the point is...
Well, but if you're going to make it, if you're going to make a statement about it, right? Because they're not making statements about the other murders, right?
Right.
But if they were, and let's say like of all these 17,000 kids that died yesterday, I don't give a shit about any of them. Okay, that's terrible, right?
Right.
The one that if you pick to talk about one, right, and your only position is, well, like gun laws or gun rights or whatever it is, right, and you don't leave even a little iota of room for, oh, shit, a 17-year-old kid is dead.
Right.
It's that kind of like,
I mean, some people
thing
did,
that I don't understand.
Some people did say that, you know.
Oh, many people did.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd say the majority did, but there were a lot of people that didn't.
Well, I think it's because of the way an event like this is a lightning rod for lots of unexpressed issues that people have based on the social stage, you know, the racism in our country, the anti-racism in our country, the anti-South in our country, the anti-gun in our country, the pro-gun in our country. The anti-crime, the anti-hoodies, the pro-vigilante. I mean, there's so many charged issues that come down to one event that it's just inevitable that it's going to be a huge news event.
It just, as you were talking about adults reaching a certain point and stuff, like I just envisioned that I wish we could all get to the point where we can talk about things like, okay, what a tragedy. This was such a senseless tragedy. Let's start with that, right? Like how awful. Feels so bad for these families. And then fine, dive a little deeper. Well, here's the issues. That subtlety is non-existent in so many places in our society.
Because it doesn't sell.
Yeah.
It's not something in the news that sells, and you need things that sell. Empathy doesn't sell. All right. Well, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us. Please take care of yourself. Watch American Psycho if you have unmet id needs because you're worth it.
Bye. Well, by the way, if you watch American Psycho, also try reading the book, even though it's going to be very hard to get through a certain portion of it because it gets so ridiculously over the top, gory and violent and disturbing.
This is not an exit. Do you have a song? American Psycho.
Oh,
baby, what I need.
No. What's the one that the New Order one they play is, I feel so extraordinary. Right. It's the is that Bizarre Love Triangle? Or
I never know the names of New Order songs.
Studio. You know, I actually never knew that the Whitney Houston song was about loving yourself. Until I saw American Psycho.
Yeah, I don't think I knew that either.
But the greatest love of all was, you know.
The greatest.
I always love just assumed of all. It was like she found something.
The greatest love of all.
I just thought she found some great
is
guy.
Easy to achieve. Is that the word?
I hope it is.